I'm 10,000 miles away, and I go home a lot to visit my constituents, and I've been in this job a long time.
Congressman Young defends his absences in Congress. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, November 14th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the state decides not to apply for a waiver from No Child Left Behind.
I'm a little disappointed, but I hope they do eventually opt out of the more onerous provisions of the law.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
The U.S. House returned to work today after a week-long recess and took up a series of non-controversial votes to name post offices after members of the military, some of whom died in battle. Alaska's Congressman Don Young was there along with his colleagues, but he's faced criticism recently for the number of votes he's missed this year. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Congressman Young has served in Washington for nearly 40 years and over the decades has been called to the carpet before for missing votes. So last month's article by the New York Times crunching attendance numbers was nothing new. The paper found that Young had the worst record of showing up to vote this year if you exclude one member of Congress with cancer, another recovering from an assassination attempt, and the two running for president. Young had missed 16% of votes, but he says don't judge him by the numbers.
The frustrating thing is they count every vote, and you can teach a monkey to vote. It's easy. Just slip the card in and feed him a banana.
Young points to votes on naming post offices as inconsequential, and he says he's not alone.
Actually, I'm pretty pleased because I believe about half of the members of Congress have missed 10% of the votes this year, too. They're not the only ones, because a lot of these votes, I think, are uncalled for.
Except Congressman Young is wrong. The New York Times shows that only 4% of House members, not half, have missed a tenth of votes this year. And 15 members have never missed a vote, like Republican Frank Lobiondo of New Jersey's 2nd District, who paused in the Capitol to comment after a recent vote.
It's what we're elected to do. We're supposed to make every vote we can. You better have a good reason if you don't make them.
But Don Young says he does have a good reason. Alaska's far distance. Senator Lisa Murkowski has missed only a handful of votes this year, and Senator Mark Begich, none. But Young says the House schedule is especially challenging.
I'm 10,000 miles away. I have a district that's bigger than all the land east of the Mississippi. Now think about that for a moment. And I go home a lot to visit my constituents, and I've been in this job a long time.
And during his tenure, Young has deflected past criticism of missing votes. Back in 2001, he had the second worst attendance record in the House. And the following year, he missed more votes than 95% of his colleagues. Despite that, he cruised to victory in 2002. Political science professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, Dr. Jerry Macbeth, says missing votes hasn't hurt Alaska's only congressman. He says Young's opponents haven't had success turning criticism of his voting record into results at the polls. But Macbeth says it should matter to Alaskans.
We expect representatives to present our views in front of other members of the Congress. And if they're not there, they can't do that.
Macbeth says, to be fair, he believes Congressman Young does hit votes on issues considered priorities for Alaska. The New York Times pointed out that Young missed a high-profile vote on a major Republican budget priority back in July because it conflicted with a long-planned fishing trip that raises money for a charity named after his late wife.
At least in terms of the New York Times article, the representatives of Congressman Young said he was off raising money to help children. He's also missed a lot of votes because he was attending fundraisers.
Congressman Young bristles at the suggestion that his priorities are out of balance and says he stands by his voting record, which he rates as a B or B+.
I don't apologize for it. I think I'm doing the job for my people. I meet with my constituents. Alaskans understand that. If I was to be criticized for anything, it's probably not going home more than I do.
Alaskans will tell the congressman whether his voting attendance matters to them next fall, when Young says he'll be running for re-election again. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
The Parnell administration missed the first deadline to apply for a waiver from parts of the federal No Child Left Behind Act of 2001. The federal standards that accompany the law have drawn criticism in Alaska, particularly in rural school districts. President Obama offered states the opportunity to apply for waivers back in September, and so far 39 states have said they want to be relieved of some of the requirements. Part of the waiver process requires that the states present alternative ways of showing student achievement. Deputy Commissioner of Education Les Moore says Alaska may apply for exemptions at the time of the final deadline next year. He says the department is considering ideas for making changes.
Our intent will be to lay out some ideas that would work, put them to print, actually test them against the data that we have to see what would the impact be on schools. If we feel we get to a stage that we're pretty comfortable with some things, then we'll want to include stakeholders. We'll want to include school district principals and teachers and superintendents and other policymakers in looking at what it would look like even before we would take the step to put it forward to the U.S. Department of Education.
Moore says the department's cautious approach will give Alaska the chance to see proposals from other states. The No Child Left Behind standards have drawn criticism from educators since it originally became law. Barbara Ngayak is president of the National Education Association Alaska. She says several elements have proven to be unworkable in Alaska, like the requirement that even tiny districts have highly qualified teachers in all subjects. She says there are aspects to the federal law that present problems for every school in the country.
You know, it doesn't really matter what type of school it is because the requirements are very difficult to handle. And some of it is so intrusive that we have too many schools where the focus has become meeting adequate yearly progress and making sure that standardized test results show what we want them to show rather than really being interested in what's happening with student learning and student achievement.
Legislators also want the state to apply for a waiver. Anchorage Democrat Les Guerra says that's what he wanted.
I hope they opt out of as many of the non-productive provisions as possible. So I'm a little disappointed, but I hope they do eventually opt out of the more onerous provisions of the law.
The final deadline to apply for a waiver is mid-February of next year. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, another huge storm hits coastal Alaska.
The highest it hit was 114. I don't know how much higher it got because my wind vane blew off.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. AlaskaPublic.org, connecting you to Alaska, one story at a time.
A Department of Defense audit says Air Force wind projects in western Alaska were poorly planned and delays could cost millions of dollars. The projects were designed to power remote radar sites that currently rely on diesel power generation. Only one turbine has been constructed so far. In 2008, a $2 million test turbine was built at Tin City, located about 100 miles northwest of Nome, near Wales. An audit by the Defense Department's Inspector General says the turbine was constructed without data from wind studies. The turbine was not operational in 2009, and the Air Force spent nearly $500,000 to fix power integration issues. The Air Force said earlier this year the turbine is producing sporadic and unusable power and continuing to incur costs. Three additional wind projects were funded 2 years ago with stimulus money, costing $4.7 million each. The money was supposed to go to shovel-ready projects. The audit says the new projects were not at that stage. The report faults the 611th Civil Engineering Squadron based at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson for mismanagement of the project. Over the weekend, what was just supposed to be a normal Bering Sea storm turned into one that claimed several boats and even a home in a few coastal villages. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
Good News Bay's Village Public Safety Officer, George Bright, said that after the big storm last week, they thought they were in the clear.
It was in the news that, yeah, the storm of the century, you know, we thought it hit up north and we weren't worried about it. We weren't expecting this.
On Friday, there was a blizzard warning for Southwest Alaska, but Saturday night brought the real storm. The smaller low system rolled in behind the much-anticipated Bering Sea storm and brought with it damaging winds and surf all Saturday night and much of Sunday. Bright checked the wind meter on his house regularly.
The highest it hit was 114. I don't know how much higher it got because my wind vane blew off.
The National Weather Service in Bethel couldn't confirm winds of over 100 miles an hour, but did get readings of over 70 miles per hour from a few villages. Back on Saturday night, though, Bright had no idea what was in store. He received a call from Platinum's VPSO across the bay who said their village was starting to flood, so Bright thought he should probably check things out. It was about 11 p.m. He drove towards his brother's house, which is located close to the water's edge.
And there was all kinds of debris. I'm like, what the heck is going on here? until I turned up my high beam on my truck and I could see the waves just, it didn't operate in my mind here what was going on. It turned out it was the waves that were hitting. There was all kinds of debris on the roadway.
A lot of the debris was stored construction material for a rural cap project, plywood, 2x4 boards, and insulation that ended up strewn across the road. By the time Bright reached his brother's house, the steam bath there had already been washed away by waves and chunks of ice. The waves also took between 6 to 12 boats that were stored for the winter in what was considered a protected area known as the Point.
The boats vary in sizes from, flat-bottom river boats to 18-foot lunge to commercial fishing boats.
Bright says some of the boats have been spotted up the Good News Bay River, about 5 miles. He says another resident is reporting losing 3 16-foot Lund boats. Other damage includes Connex vans full of stored materials floating away and the fencing along the new airport runway blowing down. There's also one home in Good News Bay located close to the water that is now inhospitable. It was pushed off of its foundation, and the village is not sure whether it can be salvaged. Bright says the storm's real intensity came when the southerly winds suddenly changed directions from east to west.
That's when we got slammed big time.
Flooded the north part of our village.
That's VPSO John Samuels in Platinum.
One guy, Danny, took reported water coming in his porch. The water reached the east side of the school, surrounded half of the building and the teacher housing.
Floodwaters also surrounded Platinum's utilities building. Samuel says it looks like the tide overflowed the spit in some areas, moving Connex vans and other metal-framed containers. Several boats in Platinum floated away as well. The winds tore some window covers off and left a lot of debris in the road. The winds and waves lasted through Sunday in both Platinum and Good News Bay. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
The state and federal governments are dispatching crews to western Alaska to survey damage from last week's storm. 40 villages are reporting damage. The governor has the option to declare a disaster in each community and activate the state's disaster assistance programs. KNOM's Ben Matheson has the story.
Teams will move out tomorrow and be based in Nome, Kotzebue, and Bethel. From there, they will travel to smaller communities to try to determine the scope of damage and put a price tag on the storm. Brian Fisher is the incident commander for the State Emergency Operations Center. He says the team spent today getting preliminary reports.
Mostly via telephone calls to all of the communities that were impacted by the storms that happened last week and this weekend. Triaging, trying to determine where the most significant damage occurred.
Fisher noted two communities in particular in the Norton Sound region to investigate, including Diomede, which had damage and lost connexes near the helipad, as well as some flooding in the water treatment plant. The community of Wales experienced damage from flooding and winds to 89 miles per hour. As the state gets a sense of damages, it will be conducting what's called a joint preliminary damage assessment with FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, in the case that federal assistance is needed. Fisher says the information from this week's surveys will first go to Governor Parnell.
So we'll take all of the information that we compile on damages in the communities and use that to formulate what we call a fact sheet for the governor's disaster policy cabinet so he can make a decision on whether this is a state disaster or not. We'll also use the information going forward if there's significant enough damage and it exceeds our capability to request a presidential disaster declaration.
Fisher hopes to have a report to the disaster cabinet early next week for the governor to be able to make a decision sometime later in the week. The governor would make the decision to ask for any federal assistance. The state had not received any requests for a disaster declaration as of this afternoon, although Fisher says several communities are looking at drafting requests. The Nome City Council is meeting this evening to consider a declaration. If the governor chooses to activate the state's disaster funding mechanisms, there are three main programs that provide help. The Public Assistance Program covers damage to public infrastructure, along with government property and the costs of operations during the storm, like running shelters and cleaning off roads. Individual Disaster Assistance provides for homeowners and private property, and another program provides funding for temporary housing if homes need to be repaired for a significant period. As cleanup operations continue along the coast, Fisher says the relatively small impact from the storm can be attributed to good preparations earlier last week.
Our communities all across the coast of Alaska were extremely well informed and well prepared, and because of the efforts of all of the communities to take care of themselves, I think that we're seeing that there's not a whole lot of damage from this huge storm that happened because of the preparations that the individual communities had taken prior to the storm and during it.
Jerry Steiger from the National Weather Service says the flooding would have been worse in Nome if the winds blew from the south at the peak of the storm surge. Winds shifted to the east instead and were weaker when water levels peaked. Reporting in Nome, I'm Ben Matheson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
An Alaska-based soldier from Arizona has been killed in Afghanistan. The Department of Defense, in a release today, identified the soldier as Sergeant First Class Jonathan B. McCain of Apache Junction, Arizona. The 38-year-old McCain died Sunday in Kandahar Province from injuries he received from a roadside bomb while on mounted patrol. McCain was stationed with the 1st Striker Brigade Combat Team at Fort Wainwright in Fairbanks. Usabelli Coal's Wishbone Hill project near Sutton could be producing in a year and a half if all goes according to plan. The coal mine has the backing of the Matanuska Susitna Borough, although some area residents who live close to the proposed mine are fighting the development. The Department of Natural Resources will hold additional public hearings on a permit renewal for the project this week in Sutton. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
The area around the Wishbone Hill mining site has been mined for years, for decades actually, going back to the early 1900s. Coal from the area fueled U.S. Navy ships until after World War II when the Navy switched to diesel fuel. Usabelli acquired the Wishbone Hill coal leases in 1997. Lorelei Simon is Usabelli's external affairs manager for the project.
Last spring, Usabelli launched a feasibility study to take a fresh look at Wishbone Hill to see if now would be the time to further develop the mine. What's valuable about Wishbone Hill coal is that it is the only bituminous coal deposit on Alaska's road system.
Bituminous coal has a low sulfur content but burns ultra-hot. Simon says Usabelli's feasibility study is based on 6 million tons of economically mineable coal with an outlook of a 500,000-ton-a-year production when the mine gets ramped up. If Usabelli decides to go ahead with the mining plan, the company will strip mine the coal, reclaiming the mined land as it goes. Asian markets hungry for coal are prompting Usabelli's renewed interest in Wishbone Hill.
If we do decide to further develop the mine, we could be up and running in about a year and a half to 2 years. The Wishbone Hill coal is actually destined for Japan. J-Power is a Japanese-based power company that is interested in purchasing all of the output from Wishbone Hill.
Currently, Usabelli's Healy coal mine supplies 6 coal-burning power facilities in Alaska. With no more coal-powered plants in the state in the offing, Wishbone Hill's production is marked for export. But the project has its detractors, and they plan to speak up at the Sutton hearing. The Mat Valley Coalition is organizing both local and Anchorage residents in an effort to sway DNR against the permit renewal. Jeremiah Millen is executive director of Friends of Mat-Su, a member of the Mat-Su Coalition.
This will be coal that will be shipped directly to Asia, and our local communities will shoulder all the burden. You have to ask yourself, what's the real benefit for Mat-Su communities? And I'd say there's very little.
Today in Anchorage, representatives from the group of conservation organizations presented Governor Sean Parnell with a petition against coal development at Wishbone Hill. They want a new public best interest finding for the Wishbone Hill lands.
Some of the issues that we have with the current permit is that the original best interest finding that was done for those lands was done in 1984. This permit has been renewed every 5 years, but it's based off of data that's over 20 years old.
A lot changes in 20 years, he says. Now the area is increasingly residential, and Millen says there are 128 families living within a mile of the mine site. Opponents of the mine fear health hazards due to coal dust and adverse impacts to water quality, again pointing out that the permit data is outdated. They want retesting done using current methodologies for water quality assurance. The Sutton public hearing on Tuesday is part of the permit renewal process. Although coal mining is regulated by the Federal Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act, individual states may develop their own coal regulatory programs consistent with federal legislation. Alaska has its own coal regulatory program, which administers coal regulations on all lands within the state and assumes primacy over the federal program. For KSKA, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
As reunions go, the yearly patient and family gathering at St. Elias Specialty Hospital provides a unique healing opportunity for patients and staff. KSKA's Len Anderson attended this Saturday's third annual celebration and has the story.
As its name implies, St. Elias Specialty Hospital in Anchorage occupies a singular niche in Alaska's healthcare community. As a partnership between BridgeCare Hospitals and Providence Health Systems, St. Elias is the state's first long-term acute care facility. Saturday was a chance for past and current clients to share their experiences at the hospital. About 60, some with family and others accompanied by attendants, did so.
I broke my back, both my legs, shattered my tailbone, my right foot, and my jaw.
And I broke my back, my left and right foot and ankle, and my arm, and my sternum.
Don and Rosemarie Evans and their two children were injured in an August plane crash near McGrath. The pilot, Ernie Chase, and ANVIC educator Julie Walker were killed. The Evans were on their way to new teaching positions at ANVIC. After their emergency and initial hospital treatment, the Evans transferred to St. Elias. There, they spent over 2 months in treatment. A few weeks ago, they were released, and the family now lives in Wasilla. The children are pretty much healthy and are in school. Don and Rosemarie remain in wheelchairs and are still working toward recovery.
We both go to therapy a few times a week together, and so right now that's the focus, is each day trying to build our strength again and hopefully to be able to walk.
It's a tough situation. But then St. Elias's chief medical officer, Dr. Terry Lester, says easy cases don't appear at the long-time acute care hospital.
Usually the polytraumas, bad wounds, chronic ventilator needs. So people are very debilitated, need daily physician rounding, a lot of micromanagement to get them better, to be able to get them to a level that they can get out of here.
Lester says oftentimes the treatment at St. Elias transcends the physical.
By the time a patient comes to St. Elias, they've been through a very long ordeal. Usually a lot of surgeries, a lot of procedures. Over here, it's a different thought process. At the other acute facilities, it's about getting the emergent medical needs stabilized to get them over here for the healing. Our patients are here for a long time, and it's a long course of recovery. Oftentimes, the patient's lost a lot of will. Oftentimes, they're asking me to give up. But you've got to be steadfast and tell them we can get you through this, and just daily making them go through the motions to get it done.
State Senator Liesl McGuire served as MC at Saturday's reunion. McGuire's relationship to St. Elias runs deep. Years ago, after her brother required acute long-term care in Washington State, McGuire's parents decided Alaska needed an in-state facility so patients and families could remain together during treatment. They worked hard toward that goal, and in 2006, St. Elias became a reality. McGuire says the annual reunion has become a part of the St. Elias healing process.
It's an opportunity, as you see, for patients and families to talk with one another and share those really intimate moments of surviving that are hard to describe to others who haven't lived through that.
She says the reunion is equally important for St. Elias staff.
When you work in a trauma hospital like this, you have really hard days because the people that walk in here, by definition, are acutely ill. As you heard, they've been run over by trucks, they've fallen off roofs, and they are in serious trouble by the time they reach this hospital. So many of them don't leave. That's very difficult for the staff. So it's a morale lifter as well for them to be here among the survivors and to realize why they get up every day.
Since opening in December 2006, St. Elias Specialty Hospital has treated more than 1,000 patients. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ben Matheson in Nome, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, and Len Anderson and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
And by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. If you receive Medicare, the time to join, switch, or drop Medicare prescription drug plans is earlier this year. It's between October 15th and December the 7th. Every year, plans change and your needs change. To find the Medicare prescription drug plan that's best for you, call Alaska's Medicare Information Office at 1-800-478-6065. That's 1-800-478-6065. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.